February 20th, 2003, West Warwick, Rhode Island. There's a glam metal band called Great White, and they're rocking the stage of the station. But in 5.5 minutes, this club is going to be engulfed by fire, leaving 100 dead, 230 people injured, and many lives permanently changed. In 2013, we're accustomed to taking in headlines of shootings, bombings, and other unexplained catastrophes. We want to know how it got started. We want to know the name of a culprit. But when the massacres pass and they disappear from the news cycle, why aren't we willing to consider the long-term effects that any kind of disaster has on a community? Daniel Woodrell's new novel, The Maid's Version, tries to address this conundrum by fictionalizing a real-life fire that plagued West Plains, Missouri in 1928. Woodrell's town is West Table, Missouri. He focuses on how this fire sends shockwaves across generations. His book is a series of taut snapshots portraying people closely related to each other, people who are trying to move forward with their lives, however fraught the results. It carries on the rich stylistic tradition that Woodrell has established through such novels as Tomato Red and Winter's Bone. I met up with Woodrell during a recent visit he made to New York City to discuss his style, his life, and his work. Okay, so I am here. Very honored to be here with Daniel Woodrell, who was most recently the author of The Maid's Version. Daniel, how are you doing?
Good, great. Good to be here.
Yes, you're a laconic man. You're down to the bone, just like your novels. You know, we've seen twists in your books before. I mean, I think of the brutal Civil War uniform swap that opens up Woe to Live On. Mm-hmm. I think of the relationship revelation after that housebreak in Tomato Red. But this book, you have been extremely opaque about the narrator's identity, to the point of, I will confess, mild frustration, but then I started to kind of get into what mm-hmm. you were doing. I'm wondering, you know, why was this kind of opacity, along with the fragmented sense of history, more your style this time around? Because, you know, I'm wondering if this was like sort of a formal exercise to see just how much material you can pack into a 165-page novel.
One, I didn't want it turn into being about him so much directly. I wanted him to be in a position to know a lot of things and to observe things and report things more than. In many ways, this book has a style that would fit nonfiction. Quite a bit of it, and that was also by design because I felt like he was trying to relay fiction, and so I wanted him to be a little bit. Outside of the, he's not the most important person in the book, or even very important, just as a messenger of the story. And I really do, really wrestle with this book in terms of what size to make it. I tried to initially make it a big fat one and include everyone, and that just got out of shape so badly that essentially threw it away and eventually realized that just the maid's version, just get down to the bone, to the part that really matters to you, or as Thelonious Monk said, just play the notes you really mean.
Yes.
And so I kind of took that to heart here, just played the notes I really meant. So
when you say this is going to be a big fat one, I mean, what were the original drafts looking like? Was it, I mean, you say that you were reporting here, and I'm wondering, you know, given the economy of the final product, so to speak, you know, what how expansive did you get here?
Well, there were a lot of different rumors about what may or may not have happened. There were a lot of different players who could have come into the picture briefly or at more length, and even the bios of some of the victims were originally quite a few pages apiece.
Yeah.
And it began to just lose shape and focus and wander too much for me. And that's a little bit depressing sometimes when you get to page 100 and something and you say, well, I think I can use 10 of these.
I mean, by the way, can we actually confess the narrator's name? I guess we can.
Yeah, his name is Alec. He is named a few times.
Yeah, he is. He is. I didn't know if the extent of spoilers. I mean, I've seen reviews do this, but okay. No. So we'll call. So he's Alec.
No. Yeah. Out of the back. And there have been people who read it and didn't catch his that he had a name and no, he is named.
Yes.
It didn't occur to me that I.
Did this book start with Alec, or, I mean, how did the reporting and how did the wrestling with history get in, become such a part of this book? We could talk about the fire that is actually a real dance hall fire in 1928 that actually is also in this book. So, you know, I mean, how what caused you to what caused your imagination to wander into this sort of factual milieu?
Well, one of the I'd heard about this ever since I was old enough to be told this kind of detail, and I eventually began to learn there were a lot of different versions of, or rumors about what might or might not have happened. And I had the very, very first time I attempted to get into this, it was omniscient, and there was no Alec, and there was no particular focus on the Donahue family. It was going to be pretty tightly, it was going to be closer to, there was a William Kennedy book I liked a lot. Nobody, a lot of other people didn't seem to, but I
Which
did.
Which one? Very Old Bones?
Flaming Corsage.
Oh, the Flaming Corsage, yeah.
And Very Old Bones.
Very Old Bones, I feel, is very underrated. Yeah,
I think it is, too. I really like that. I love Kennedy, period, but so I'm not really capable of being unbiased toward him.
Yes.
But I liked that a lot, and I kind of felt like it moved a certain story through history rather well, and it certainly kept me going.
But his kind of montage nature in that book sort of appealed to you for this.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
It did.
That totally makes sense.
So I originally it was going to be, you know, here's the maid for a minute, and then here's someone else, and here's someone else, and they're all linked together, and the story would expand from there and go forward. But I slowly over a period of time realized that the personal part of it, that is the Donahue family's interior relationship to this, was fundamental to me, really. I just hadn't recognized how important that part of it was to me, and it began to seem to me that that was the way to go into this.
I'm curious, at what point did the dance hall start to inform the kind of snapshot approach? Was it more the dance hall, or was it more the Kennedy book, The Flaming Corsage, out of curiosity?
Well, you go around town talking about the real event, and you get little snippets.
Ah, I see.
And there'll be a number of the victims are kind of remembered by one thing that was notable about them, or that was often reported about them. She played the piano, or he was a good ball player, or something like that. And so over a period of time, these characters, as they're discussed sitting around town with other citizens, they begin to be have two or three things that have stuck about them in the minds of the people there. And I began to realize, yeah, that's right. There are certain essential qualities of people that linger for 85 years this year.
Yeah.
And so that kind of informed those. And I definitely wanted the victims to be brought forward somehow. And I didn't want it all to just be, you know, 35 people walking toward the dance or something.
Sure.
So
you felt a responsibility to imbue the victims with some kind of identity as opposed to them just being random names.
Yeah.
This brings me to the cemetery, which forms a serious part of this book. I mean, Alma always ends her walks there. We learn at the very beginning, but then we learn about the dance hall owner, whose past is actually revealed through the cemetery, a lot of his associations. And I was wondering, first and foremost, well, did you wander around the cemetery yourself looking for leads here, or was this kind of a way for you to remind both the readers and also to imbue the town with additional life that, you know, here is this marker of memory. All these people have died, and you can't escape your legacy. I mean, what was the appeal of this?
Well, one, by an accident of just chance, fair portion of my family are buried only about 50 feet from the memorial. So all my life when we'd go over to put the flowers down for Memorial Day and so forth, what's this? And slowly that would develop. And then also by happenstance, a number of the people who were identified are also buried very near there. That was the section of the cemetery that was then being filled. And so as I began to learn more and more of the names of the people who were actually relevant to the event, I began to realize, oh, they're all planted right around here. So it began to that very fact resonated with me. And I'm not I never say that I know what happened, because I don't know what happened. I chose a story that really rang for me and went with it, but I could walk around town and find a number of people who are still debating a lot of different angles that I never even really suggested.
This leads me to ask, I mean, what obligation do you really have to history? I mean, this is in your first novel. Mm-hmm. You explored the Kansas Irregulars in the mm-hmm. Civil War novel. In this, you're dealing with something that's, I think, a little bit more local than that, mm-hmm. because, and also your family history. I mean, the Civil War, even the Kansas Irregulars, offers a really wide canvas for the imagination to bristle.
Right.
But in this, you're dealing with something that is so hyper-local that I wonder if you have any problems, I guess, bending the truth as fiction requires, or whether you just kind of run with the actual basis and just kind of let things go into place from there.
Well, none of the people who were allegedly in the periphery of this, or maybe even toward the center of it, appealed to me as members of the community and as historical things, but not as fictional characters. I really didn't want to write about I didn't feel drawn to write about people with some of the characteristics that these rumored individuals actually presented. I specifically didn't want to write about the wealthy in town all sitting around twisting their mustaches thinking of villainy to perpetrate upon the lower classes.
Was there a real banker?
There was a banker who was sometimes mentioned as having had something involved, maybe, but he was a much more dangerous kind of guy and a relentless skirt chaser and all that. Not the character I found myself writing about. I thought that it was in the same way that I ended up writing about the Southern Bushwhackers instead of the Northern. I'd originally started out to write a book about the Northern, and then I realized, well, that was actually a little too easy for me to inhabit that sensibility, and it was more of a stretch for me politically and as a person to try to get inside the other side and what was making them tick. And so I wanted this character to be someone that I found more that it would be more of a surprise if he were accidentally or purposely involved in something.
So part of the appeal of the Maid's version and all these little bits and anecdotes you were collecting was to really inhabit the other in this way.
Yeah. Yeah. And as time went on, I realized more and more it's the key to the whole book to me is just the Donahue family story.
Yeah.
That the dance hall and some of the surrounding qualities of that or after effects of that were propellants to the Donahue family's shift over a generation and a half or two.
I actually really wanted to ask you about sort of a tilt I detected in your writing style with Tomato Red, where suddenly you have sentences that demand almost this total life through language. Of course, a lot of this is probably evident because of that amazing first paragraph in Tomato Red, but I wanted to actually point it out by reading one of the sentences from Tomato Red. "This pinto pooted, small gray distress signals from the tailpipe and sounded like a chain smoker at a cold dawn and practically shrieked for a civil rights lawyer when I forced it up hills." So aside from the simile, we have pinto pooted and we have up hills split into two words. I'm wondering, you know, with this book, you know, did you need to have that voice of Sammy Barlock to just really get these sentences? Is perspective really the way for you to kind of evolve as a stylist? I mean, I was hoping to get something about this.
Yeah, very much. Yeah. And Sammy was, I'm trying to think, probably the first voice I did that was quite, he's not unhinged or anything, but he definitely sees everything from a little bit of a different angle than most of us probably do. And I thought of Sammy very much as sort of an expressionist. I mean, he's looking at the real world, but he's just not seeing it exactly the way most people see it. And so that began to suggest a richness of language because of the insights he was having that kind of called for that. And I'm definitely, it wouldn't be any fun for me to write if I wasn't allowed to let the language run amok, and then hopefully if it's really amok, I'll catch it in time to trim it back. But that's a big motivating force for me to write it all. So,
but I was wondering if that was sort of the aha moment for you. I mean, I like the other books before mm-hmm. that, but that one really sort of amps things up to this level where the language and the character are absolutely one in a way that, that it continues mm-hmm. with the subsequent books. And, right. And it's interesting that with the Maid's version, you go to kind of this more succinct approach to also try to inhabit that kind of sentence. I mean, did the structure of this book kind of... was it almost kind of an obstacle for the kind of language perspective approach? Or I mean, I was wondering about
that. Well, Tomato Red, I agree with you on that. I often have said I felt like something started to click there that I wasn't fully cognizant of just what all was going on. In fact, it was only when I had occasion to look at it maybe a year after I'd finished it, I began to recognize more of what was going on in there. And in this book, I just didn't want this one to get... I didn't want one character to tell the story in such a forceful way that they precluded all other possible interpretations or something, that it was just so forcefully about them that they would overshadow everything else. And that's part of the reason why Alec is a little to the side. And he also, it's also a book where I don't have a bunch of... you know, motherfucker this and motherfucker that, you know. This book, actually, I didn't, and it wasn't really on purpose initially, and then I was reading through it, and I realized, oh, you're not, where's your standard?
You know, I think, though, the respect for the grief of this town is probably what motivates that. And maybe, it would seem to me anyway, that what you were trying to do language-wise with this was to give voice to the town as opposed to one solitary perspective. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. And... a couple things, like people are introduced as Mr. or Mrs., and certainly a generation and a half or two ago, almost that would be standard.
Yeah.
The lady next door was not Joan, you know. It was Mrs. Henry Easthall, you know. I mean, I kind of wanted to, and that suggests a certain kind of decorum and regard and circumspection.
Yeah. What about some of the vernacular, the Ozarks vernacular that is often in your books? I mean, John Law for cop. I don't read any other novels that refer to cops as John Law like that, and it's quite pleasant to get that kind of word appear like that. I'm wondering, you know, do you have any kind of, like, really list that you keep at home that, or is this largely intuitive? I mean, where does some of the...
It's mostly just been absorbed over a lifetime. I have heard others who use the term John Law. And I'm sure I've seen it in books, too. And I often get confused if I heard someone say it or if I read someone saying it about these things, because everything gets mixed. But that is definitely a term that you hear once in a while, that one. A lot of the slang words and everything I hear, I'm just a magnet for it. And it's like referring to Parmesan as sprinkle cheese. The first time I heard someone actually say that, it's not common. I don't hear it everywhere, but I have heard it a few times. And that really, I knew I was going to find a place for that, sprinkle cheese. So I pay attention to language, and I absorb it, and I do once in a while get out the OED or something and thumb through because it's pretty good read.
Yeah, you can get lost in that.
Yeah, you sure
can. Do you have the full several volumes set of the magnifying glass?
The magnifying glass thing. Yeah.
I wanted to kind of ask you about the food in this. I will confess to you that, I mean, normally you read a Woodrell book and there's a lot of meat. But in this, there was one moment with a depression stew, and maybe I was hungry at the time, but I was like saying, oh, this is pretty good for hand-me-down food and all that. And then I started becoming very attuned to much of the food that's in the Maid's version. And I was wondering, you know, did you want to kind of, I guess, push off of the meat this time and offer a few...
Many people wouldn't have had meat or much. And the other thing is, even my mother was someone who would keep a pot on the stove in a big black Dutch kettle kind of thing, and you just keep adding to it every day. So eventually the green beans are black because of the fat back in the bottom, but she'd just keep adding, oh, let's throw another handful of potatoes in, and maybe something else will show up that fits with it. And so that was pretty common to do that. You just had to reboil it every day.
Yeah.
And we used to have it sit there quite a long time sometimes. It tastes really good.
Well, aside from beans, what else did you put in it out of curiosity?
Well, fat back, and maybe you have some ham one day, and that throw a chunk of that or a bone in. And there's a kind of beans that'll fit with whatever else is in there, that's always great. And
you still have stew on the in the Woodrow household these days, or
yeah, we do, but make it a little more traditionally.
Yeah, traditionally like hasso.
Well, more like potatoes and a carrot yeah. and an onion, and not necessarily throw in just anything that's laying around. But
what do you think people get wrong the most about stew, out of curiosity? What do you think, like, you know, is there some sort of hack stew?
Well, you know, the fact is, if you're not worried about the health consequences of it or anything, any kind of stew pot that's been going a long time with some greasy fat in the bottom ends up tasting good.
Yeah, it's the risks.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to also talk with you about the prostitution and the sexual rituals that are very mm-hmm. often in your work. I think of Bev's demand for a gift in Tomato Red. I think of the methodical way in which Ruby cleans the smell off of people in the maid's version. I have to ask, sir, how did you cultivate this knowledge? I mean, you know, was this a matter of reading, knowing people, researching? I mean, you know, what was
a little bit of all those things. We used to have a woman live down by our garden who was a pulled-up hooker, and as they said, meaning she didn't do it anymore, supposedly, but had. And she seemed like just a perfectly ordinary, poorly educated resident of the region there. Nothing special about her, and God bless her if that she attracted a clientele, because there was, you know, she was not presented in a way that would be irresistible or anything.
It wasn't so much marketing; it was the law of averages,
right? Yeah. Right. And I'd been around a lot as a kid, and one of the girls I had a crush on in junior high, I'm gone for a few years and come back, and she's hooking, and that was it. Just people you knew ended up doing this instead of just some stranger, and that made an impact on me. And there are a lot of people who survive basically by learning how to manipulate others, and that's not an uncommon thing. And Ruby's certainly one of those. She learned she has something that attracts people, and that by pulling them towards her, she can maneuver them around, and so she does that.
So by way of pretty much knowing everybody in a town, you can pretty much know most of humanity.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I found most fun about this book, was that for the first time in a long time, you could have a character who was well-educated and even worldly and somewhat traveled and all the rest of it in the same paragraph with someone who didn't get past third grade.
Yeah. You have pointed out in other interviews that the Ozarks really don't have any street crime, mm-hmm. And that most crime occurs among, well, people who are acquainted with each other. In the maid's version, Plug becomes very aware of an interior truth where he doesn't really like tough guys with gaudy hats, humorless jokes, gleeful violence. I'm wondering how much you share this aversion, first and foremost, and I'm wondering, are there any worthwhile qualities as a fiction writer for criminal strangers who lurch in this kind of tough guy mode?
Yeah. Well, they're appealing to write about and think about, and part of the thing about bad guys, tough guys, or whatever, that I think really is the base draw of them to the popular audience, is they are decisive. They do not sit around mumbling and moaning about maybe this, maybe that. They'll tend to do something promptly. Now, in actual life, having known guys whose first response to almost anything is to club you over the head, I didn't like them very much.
That wouldn't be a downside.
Right. And I couldn't say
would
that.
Would you like to come over for dinner?
Right. And it's not like they're going around looking for fair fights. Yeah, they're going around looking for people who
fights
are
they can win.
Easily beaten.
Yeah.
And
wow.
So I'm not, you know, cheering on for that, but I do recognize that often the kinds of dramatic things I'm called to end up involving guys just like that.
So it almost seems that you're trying to, in some sense, fight against the cliche of the guy who wants an easy fight within a small town, which is extremely interesting because, well, if you look to much fiction, that's exactly how it's defined by the sort of, the more melodramatic you get, the more you see of that.
Right, yeah. Well, it's interesting. I saw an interview with a guy from Brooklyn, an actor.
Yeah.
I think it was Tony Danza, actually.
Oh, really?
Who was a pretty tough kid, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. And actually a real boxer as well.
Yeah, and they asked him, did you ever lose? And he said, well, sure I lost. He said, if you never lose a fight, you're being real careful about who you'll fight. I thought, yeah, there's something to that.
What kind of fights did you lose with the characters in the Maid's version? Were there any characters who you had to just get rid of because they just didn't work within the grand arc here?
There were some of the victims that I thought were just one too many, or whose bios were coming a little too close to some of the other things that were already there. And not that less is more all the time, but in this case, I thought five or six of these was all you could really use and have them be effective. So there was that. And there were other avenues I could have gone down quite a bit. There is a shooting involving the sheriff in the book, and in actual life, that was the Mall Barker gang actually killed the sheriff right across the street from where the dance hall was.
Wow!
And it was in a distant cousin of mine owned the garage where the shooting occurred, and I thought, oh, that turned into a labyrinthian maze there.
How does anybody testify at a trial?
Yeah, that's
everyone
right.
Knows everybody.
Yeah. Well. There was never any trial for that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so it seems to me that you were really working very hard to make sure that every single character was distinct and separate from the other ones.
That's what I wanted.
You know, what do you do when two characters are just too close, or too close in type, or too close in personality? I mean, what do you do in a situation like that? How long does it take to unravel something like that?
Yeah, that would actually. I'm almost always trying to avoid that. I would say I'm always trying to. I may have differing degrees of success at avoiding it, but I'm always trying to avoid that. And one of the things I liked about Plug was that he did have this sense now that, you know, that wasn't the best of me that was involved in that stuff, and I don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah, despite his name.
Yeah, right. That's, you know, rather, I found that appealing. I could have probably gone on longer about Plug.
Yeah. I wanted also to talk with you about families, whether genetic or surrogate. They have very often adopted this approach of covering up or accepting behavior. The way that Alma looks the other way in the Maid's version, or the crank cooking in Winter's Bone, or Shuggy Akins's obliviousness in The Death of Sweet Mister. This idea of just not prying into other people's business, of not speaking out, I mean, it seems to me obviously this would come from your background, but why do you think this makes for, I suppose, better fiction, better examination of human behavior than people who are flagrant about who they are?
Well, I think, the first response you'd normally have might be to seek some sort of official intervention. And when you've realized that that's basically off the table for most of these people from the beginning, then now you begin to either you have to completely remain oblivious to it, or you have to subtly, or perhaps not even so subtly, try to have some sort of impact on it. And then it becomes a completely different interior challenge within the family. I'm shocked. I'm kind of addicted to these true life murder things that are on TV. There's a couple channels that show them relentlessly. Over and over, you'll see some middle class kid commit murder or something, and boy, mom's trying to help him get to Mexico, you know. Not from a criminal clan at all. It's just some sort of instinct kicks in for preservation. And I personally think that if a relative of mine just went around wantonly killing someone, that I don't think I would cover for him. But yeah. I could be wrong.
You've never been in that position.
No, right? I haven't been in that position. But if they'd done something more modest or something that was questionable, perhaps so. But
do you think that much of regional literature and Southern literature especially is defined by this idea of acceptance and wrestling with that acceptance through action as opposed through judgment, or at least keeping that judgment underneath the surface?
I mean, both things. Yeah. I think the two main threads there. And the history of the Yeoman South and so forth, as they always say in books about it, was that you recognize that if you got crossways with the guy that owned the plantation or whatever, there wasn't much you could do openly about it, which is why so much violence happened in the dark and where there were no witnesses on the trail and so forth, and why that kind of legacy underlays a lot of your thinking, even if you don't actually know anyone who's ever done that. And maybe no one around you has known anyone who's done that for a generation or two. But that legacy lays in there as if it's a possible response. I was actually thinking about something having to do with one of my brothers, and my younger brother and I were kind of laughing about it in the sense that a generation or two ago, see, we'd be expected to go do something about this.
Yeah.
It was a problem he made. He caused it. Didn't come out well, and we didn't in this generation, but it was something still in there deeply enough that it came to our minds, or, you know, and and we dismissed it, but it's in there.
Yeah. Do you think any reading of Southern literature kind of tilts some of these real life concerns about whether you would rat on your brother or whether mm-hmm. you would deal with an aberration from your family member that because you're reading and writing, and that's also as much a part of responding to the world. I mean, does any of the thematic aspects of Faulkner or McCarthy kind of factor into?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm often cagey enough to deny any knowledge of Faulkner, but.
Yeah, but that's kind of impossible. Right. I think it's impossible for any writer.
Yeah. Right. But you're right, in Massachusetts, whatever, you know, probably have had some Faulknerian influence. Faulkner covers the whole wide range. He covers the whole broad spectrum of the citizens of Yaknapatawpha and Jefferson and all that. Cormac's a little more monofocused, especially in his Tennessee era, to the dark side, basically. And oddly enough, I still find those to be his books that I can't resist, but most.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you would go forth without having had some influence from all that.
Well, it looked like with the trilogy, you were doing a sort of Yoknapatawpha thing there mm-hmm. as well, and then mm-hmm. you kind of said, no, each of these novels is actually a discrete entity and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, a little bit, too, in that was actually, I liked all kinds of crime fiction, and Ed McBain just made up his own city.
Yeah, yeah.
And that idea appealed to me. Just create your own little world that way if you decide you need a neighborhood of a certain sort or something, boom, I created it. I'll just shove it in there. And
Well, I also wanted to ask you about the way you depict home life. I mean, I'm very well aware when I read your books of how the houses are sort of bundled together and how small they are from the mm-hmm. outside. But in the inside, we often see them defined more by texture and distance, which I find really interesting. I even though you often describe, like, you know, hard nouns like, you know, copper plate ovens or whatever, we still really are aware of the texture and the distance more. And I almost feel like when I'm reading the homes in your book that I'm still approaching it from the outside. And I'm mm-hmm. wondering if this is a conscious move on your part to kind of force the reader, hey, you know, this is really your view of this particular mm-hmm. region, and you, in my case, I'm a guy from Brooklyn, so mm-hmm. I'm totally incriminated here. But I mean, I'm wondering if this is a strategy for you to get people to even move beyond your books and into these particular regions so that they can really get a sense of what it is to live like that.
Well, I like talking to people as if I think they already know what I'm talking about somewhat.
Yeah, yeah.
As if, especially in Tomato Red, that was one where he talks to you as if you know, you've probably done a little time yourself. But he has that sort of approach to people. So I don't like to present it as some exotic thing you never heard of, per se. I like to find a way to write about these things as if you may well already be somewhat familiar with it, and this may remind you of that instead of just some totally new experience for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but that's interesting, too, that you choose that whole L'Outremont kind of thing for Tomato Red, because he is a guide, but at the same time, you know, you have to kind of fill in the details if you don't live in that region.
Yeah.
And right. So, you know, I mean, do you want your, especially the sort of linguistic protagonists, to be guides or at all? I
mean,
obviously.
Somewhat. Yeah. You know, one of the things for me is I actually think elision creates energy. I think not spelling everything out creates energy in the reader if they're, you know, a good reader paying attention. So some readers I know get frustrated with that. Yeah. But, you know, never going to get that from me, the fuller account. But I actually feel like that creates the urge to turn and to feel a little bit unsure that you know everything that's going on is fine. Yeah. I like that. And I think that's part of the tension I'm trying to maintain in the reader as I go along. So I like tightly composed things that don't necessarily spell everything out, that may be present and suggested and so forth, but not bluntly stated.
I wonder how much of this was informed by the early years where you weren't selling a lot of books, mm-hmm. you weren't getting a lot of attention, you kind of threw up your hands in the air and said, you know what, look, if people want to read it, they'll read it. If mm-hmm. if not, not, I don't have any kind of stake in this or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, now I look at that and say that wasn't so bad of a position to be in because I was fortunate in that people continued to want to publish the books that I finished. But also, I never felt like, oh, God, what's Times going to say? Nothing. No, which
no
is
reviews,
crazy.
You don't have to worry. Right. Well, with the decline of book review sections, you may yeah, actually get back
right.
to that.
Yeah. And, actually, you know, the Times, actually, I shouldn't have used them because they normally have said something, at least. But I didn't feel like the spotlight of the world's going to be on this, so you better not try something that doesn't work. You could try all kinds of. When I did Tomato Red, I thought this might not fly, but they ended up doing fine with the editors and everything. Everybody liked it and wanted to publish it, but I felt free to just follow him out and let him. The more chances he took, the better, and that isn't always the case. I've always thought about it. If you'd have sold 150,000 hardbacks on book two or something, it'd be a whole other world.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Why do you think, though, for so long you were able to have publishers and editors who still believed in you, even though the sales track was not the best? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a lot of writers need to have that for several books before they find the breakout book. I mean,
it started low and went backwards for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be honest. I had an editor named Marion Wood who stuck with me for quite a few books when there was no big payoff for that, except that she liked the books, she liked the writing, she wanted to see you keep writing. So that really ended up being one of the factors that kept me going for so long. And then I also do want to keep trying to do things I haven't already done. And Pat Strawn, who I'm with now, also, if it's all about you enjoying it and the language and everything, and make it fresh, and she's interested.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, and this may go back to some of what we were talking about with the small town, if you look at any tragedy with a population ratio standpoint in mind, something like the dance hall, well, this is going to have a tremendous effect mm-hmm. on a small town. But you look at something like, say, the Boston Marathon bombings, mm-hmm. and even though this gets in the news and people get scared and the whole city goes into lockdown, it's not going to have as huge of an impact on Boston as a whole as, say, this dance hall fire did for this Missouri town. So, you know, I'm wondering, do you feel in any way that larger cities just don't always comprehend the impact that, say, a tragedy?
I think in the Boston case, it's that they came to what is being called a solution on it.
Yes.
And the case in this small town is, had there been some obvious and widely accepted explanation for what happened, it might not linger the way it has. But it's the fact that there are still some questions floating around, many questions floating around, probably more now than at one time because people wouldn't speak about it much at one time. So it probably loosened up over the last 25 years, which is why I heard a lot of things that you might not have heard 50 years ago.
Well, it is also interesting how a small town can allow for speculations as to why this explosion occurred, far more than some of the conspiracy theories that are often attached to everything. In fact, the Boston Marathon bombing did have that with the Reddit crowd and all that, and 9/11 conspiracy theories and all that. I mean, there's more of an understanding, or it's more liberal to allow something like that as a kind of coping mechanism for grief, which is interesting.
Yeah, well, many people have suggested, even locally, that it was just too much to accept that somebody threw a cigarette into something or something completely off the cuff like that. It's kind of, as you say, more comforting to think that there were conscious forces involved, and so it wasn't just some bizarre accident. And I really don't know. I can see a plausible explanation for two or three of the versions that I've heard. And so it doesn't bother me, but I do think that that's one of the reasons you couldn't talk about it, too, is because some of the rumors did involve people who survived, and it was just too raw.
So it seems to me that much of grief, no matter what the scale, is almost defined by a kind of belief culture, that we bring to grief what we choose to believe about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think if you felt that, as in this case, Alma, she felt that there had been something wrong done on purpose and it had cost her sister, that's really hard to get over.
Yeah.
That's really hard to get over.
I'm really curious, because I'm from San Francisco. I know that you actually moved to San Francisco and attempted to write a book about a B-movie actress in San Francisco, and then you had to actually abandon that book, and this is right before Give Us a Kiss.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, a lighthearted book.
Right.
You know, and you went back to the Ozarks, and then you went to, and did that book, and I'm curious about this. Is it something about San Francisco that you couldn't really work into fiction? Was it your own temperament? You know, why didn't the city mesh with your fiction?
It's funny. I love San Francisco.
Yeah.
I loved living there. I was at Treasure Island a little while in the Marines, and I hitchhiked back out there as a kid because I loved it so much. But I realized, I don't know the town, the society. I don't know. I didn't feel like I knew the social structure of it all that well. I was picking up things, you know, as the weeks went by living there, but I didn't feel like I had assimilated that well. I think I might have been able to get away with the book about the B-movie actress because she was it wasn't really going to be that important that the place be expertly opened up and understood in any fresh way. It was going to be require mostly understanding her. And that's part of the reason when the Ozarks thing happened, I realized, no, I need to follow this out, because I immediately had a sense that I know this place as well as I'm ever going to know any place. I'll never know any other place as well, probably, just because of the generations of stories and so forth, that have, some of which have reached me at least, and this sense that I understand other time periods because I can place an anecdote about a relative or something in 1910 or 1920 or something. And San Francisco, almost probably too rich and too glamorous for me at that time to try to tackle. But I loved living there. Had a great time.
So the social structure, though, of a town is going to change as well. And I'm wondering why that's more manageable than, say, examining a San Francisco subculture or a small slice of San Francisco. Do you feel you just want to get the whole enchilada? Or?
Well, I feel like the social structure of the town I live in isn't that much different, and even some of the same families from 85 years ago would still feature prominently in any discussion of various aspects of town. Not negative necessarily, just whose word can get a new highway built and whose word can't, and that kind of thing. San Francisco, I probably could have focused on just a coterie of sharp-eyed old noir actresses who go to the noir festival at the Castro every year, and you know all of that.
Have you been to that noir festival?
No, I never did get there.
Yeah, I'm sure you know Eddie Muller.
Yeah, I
went there, and I went there every single night. Yeah. It was amazing. Yeah, that guy's an encyclopedia inside his head.
I know. I know Eddie slightly, and I can't believe I never got there, but I never did.
Oh yeah.
And I'm a nut for old noir too, and it different times I was, like when I wrote Tomato Red, I was just wallowing in old noir late night. The more obscure, the better.
Yeah.
So,
okay. What about the Vietnam Marine novel you've been working on? I mean, is that a matter of trying to wrestle with a past that was so far away? Why has that been slow to come?
You know, it's it means something to me because that was a crucial time for me. I went in young, and that was my junior and senior year of high schools where I was that age while I was in the Marines. A lot of stuff was going on. It was the Marine Corps I thought I was entering was basically ill-informed kid expecting the World War II kind of Marine Corps where you felt the culture basically behind you and so forth. It was not that way. And the first times I was ever called out to do anything, it was to guard the gates against the anti-war protesters who looked like all your pals from home and stuff. And
some of my friends.
Right, that's right.
You're that guy. No.
Yeah, and it was a very different experience than what I had thought I was wandering into because I just wasn't very politically aware or anything. I quickly learned a lot, but and that's if I do go back to that book, that's the part that I think most needs to be discussed was the idea of growing to accept the necessities of certain kinds of civil disobedience, which I don't think you'll ever get away with again the way things are looking now. I don't know if you can have a mass civil disobedience anymore.
Yeah.
But that, to me, always seemed like something in the American spirit. And one of the things that happened to me in the Marine Corps was that I was promised, I was a working class kid, my dad didn't make a lot of money. They promised me 26 months of jet mechanics training if I would sign for 4 years, and then I forgot to have a special contract drawn up, so I ended up in artillery, and I was very, very, I felt shanghaied. I said, I don't owe you anything now. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to go to jail because they're pretty quick to throw you into jail, but for various infractions. But my attitude went south. I did enough good work. I was actually about to become a corporal when I was discharged for drug activity.
Oh, really?
my attitude, I began to say, no, that's your government lying straight to your face, man. You don't count. You don't matter. They said, well, shut up. It's 4 years out of your life is a drop in the bucket. I said, I'm 17. 4 years looks like a big old chunk of 17.
Yeah.
And so that threaded through with what was going on about opposition to the war and everything. It ended up being a very different kind of military experience. And I did not go to combat. But very interested in there were a lot of things going on with desertion was really high and insubordination was really high and a lot of drugs.
Yeah. So do you think that that fiction writing has triggered any dormant political impulses at all? Or, you know, being aware of the town allows you to be further aware of political forces that cause people to
I think anytime you take people such as many of my characters and you try to treat them as humans, right, it's political, right, already.
Yeah.
As soon as you do that. I'm not a big I would be more polemical if I was sure which what was what. But I'm a lot less sure as time goes on. I used to have very harsh hard opinions on a lot of matters, but I do think that these books have a political quotient underneath it all. And that's always been part of what I wrote. When I first started writing, it was nonfiction all about politics. And I turned out not to necessarily have a gift for that, but the impulse was there. And certainly coming out of the Marine Corps at that time, and then I messed around with the Young Socialist Alliance and some other things when I was got out of the Marines. I've been alerted to certain historical things and political aspects that I was eager to write about, but I didn't want to do it so bluntly. And that's part of the thing with the Marine Corps book is to allow it to be about a human in the times instead of some, I wouldn't have Woodstock in it, and then, so forth.
Yeah, the greatest hits of a particular era.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And I actually
think the flower in the rifle barrel. Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, avoid that. But I do think the idea of how someone, lower middle class, whatever we're going to call it, gets transformed into, in essence, a kind of lefty by the time I came out, through only contact, 90% of it was through contact with veterans.
Yeah.
And at the time, the morale and everything was so low that you used to have officers say, hey, I'm taking off my bars and we can just rap as friends. And everybody say, don't believe them, man. Some guys did. And they would get very hot in there. And really, issues of the war and everything were debated right in front of me in a way that I had not heard in person. And it led to a rapid... I never had a veteran tell me, you need to get there before it's over. I never did. Some of the lifers said that. And we invaded Cambodia when I was in boot camp, and they handed out cigars.
Yeah.
And they said, if the politicians don't fuck it up, looks like we got ourselves another nice little war.
This would explain why the maid's version was not a fat cigar.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Daniel, it was a pleasure to chat. Thank you so much. It was great. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
All right, fantastic.